Could you build a business that's better for our planet? That's what I have set out to answer. Hi, I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert and entrepreneur and host of the podcast, Someone Like You. I become fascinated in finding creative climate solutions in business, and on the podcast, I break down how founders and CEOs are building climate-friendly business solutions that are opportunities for growth while being better for the planet. In this episode, we speak with Michael Green, a visionary architect at the forefront of mass timber construction. His innovative books, The Case for Tall Wood Buildings and Tall Wood Buildings Design, Construction, and Performance, as well as his influential TED Talks, have reshaped urban architecture, promoting sustainable materials like cross-laminated timber and Gulam beams. As co-founder of Michael Green Architect, Michael leads a team recognized globally for their innovative designs that prioritize environmental responsibility. From the iconic T3 building in Minneapolis, designed to retain carbon, to advocating for policy change in mass timber construction, Michael's impact is profound. Discover how Michael's firm integrates social and environmental values into every project, and learn about his pioneering initiatives like design build research and timber online education. In this episode, we also discuss how purpose, focus, and vision has led to their incredible growth of their business, how media has been incredibly impactful to their awareness from books and TED Talks, how doing the right things has led to business success, like developing Google's office, creating a playbook that can be replicated for driving change and awareness. We talk about plant-based building materials and the fact that the built world represents 40% of global emissions. We also talk about creating a new venture fund to support the development of plant-based materials moving forward. From educational outreach to award-winning architecture, Michael Green is paving the way for a greener, more sustainable future in urban development. Enjoy this fascinating conversation.
Rules are constructs of human imagination, and therefore they are a continuum. They are not a fixed point. And so a bad rule needs to be changed. And we need, as society, as we have such huge problems to solve, we need to get way better at understanding that every rule can change. Some of the rules of physics, maybe not so much, but a lot of the human-made rules can be changed. It's been profoundly helpful because I think in my profession, there's a tendency to be pretty inside the boundaries. And it's really hard to innovate when you stay too inside those boundaries. So I've always believed that the more you can retain a kind of childlike state of curiosity and a little bit of that rebellious state of being a kid that doesn't want to follow the rules, ultimately, the more innovative and imaginative you can be.
Michael, welcome to the Someone Like You podcast.
Marco, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm excited for this conversation, obviously because of the work that you've done, but really the kind of dedication to thinking about things a little bit more boldly and broadly and how they are applicable internationally has been a big focus of your career, especially as of late. So what I wanted to get started with is understanding, like, when did you kind of make this correlation between business and climate? And was that earlier part of just childhood? Was that a part of schooling or career? Like, what got you starting to think, I want to be part of this change?
Yeah, it's a great place to start. So I guess in a way, there's sort of three chapters of my story there. The first chapter was growing up in mostly Eastern Canada, born in the Canadian Arctic, deep connection to environment, deep connection to wilderness, deep connection to adventure sports. Still to this day, a big rock climber, ice climber, mountain climber. And that connection to the wilderness has been, you know, deeply rooted in my core values since I was a child, and really promote an adventurous life. I still climb in the Himalaya to this day and spent part of my life as a mountain climbing guide. And so that time in the wilderness obviously connects you not just to environment, but the changing climate. And so that's sort of chapter one for me in a way. And then chapter two is becoming an architect, where I realized in my early days going to university down in the States, practicing for a really famous architect, that the environment and climate were really not a major part of the conversation when I was a young architect. In fact, not at all. And to some extent, there was almost my industry, the architecture industry, was almost looked down on the issue as that sort of Hansel and Gretel architecture of people trying to make buildings that are integrated into the wilderness or somehow responsive to our impact on the climate and environment. And so, like many industries, there was this not only general lack of knowledge about it, but there was actually, to some degree, a bit of disdain for environmental architecture. And then finally, the third chapter for me was this sort of moment 20 plus years ago where I really reflected on my life and my career and the intersection of that life in the wilderness with the intersection of this profession that I didn't see. You know, I'm building cities, but I'm not seeing this deep-rooted importance of nature in the built environment. And I sort of really started investing into understanding what the impact buildings have on climate. For the audience, you may not know, but globally, buildings represent 42% of man's greenhouse gas emissions, both the operating and building, the making of the building, which is far bigger than any other sector. In Canada, it's almost 50% is buildings. And, you know, we talk about cars and all these other things, but buildings are the hugest, the biggest impact in the world. And so when I saw that, I realized, well, I have to change everything. And in that process, I really returned to my roots of using natural materials. And I started my firm, Michael Green Architecture, I guess now 12 years ago. And in that process, I had had a previous firm that didn't have this same alignment and this commitment to climate. And I really defined my firm 12 years ago when I started, restarted it as a climate-focused firm. And that was the single best business decision I could have ever made. And that's where chapter three is to this day.
And, you know, similar, I grew up in northern British Columbia, and I did a lot of fishing and a lot of outdoors as well. And I know it, getting kids in the environment doesn't automatically mean they're going to be environmentalists, but it definitely has an impact when, you know, you're a child and catching these big fish and, you know, 15 years later, those fish are gone. And you're like, whoa, that was very quick in my lifetime that it has an impact to you to really kind of see how the environment and climate has an impact on people very tangibly. So you had an idea to start MGA and really with a focus on climate and on natural materials. So a large part of your career has been around putting mass timber at the forefront. I would love to understand, like, where did you get that kind of connection and awareness to this being, you know, an alternative solution to some of the impactful ways that we're building? And thanks for sharing that. I figured that number, the built environment, was close to 40%. And so it's just an obscene number. And like you said, we often will go to the things that are maybe a little bit more, maybe not easier to fix because electric cars are still hard, but the built environment is such an impact. So how did you kind of initially kick off the MGA business, and where was that idea for mass timber and natural environments come from?
Yeah. So, you know, really I returned, I'd worked for this architect in the States named Cesar Pelli, who is one of the most famous architects in the world. And I was building really the world's biggest buildings. As a young architect, I worked on the Petronas Towers that became, it's that pair of towers in Malaysia that became the world's tallest for a time. And so I'd come from this environment of building some pretty substantial and prestigious buildings. And when I came back to Canada and to British Columbia, I immediately sort of remembered that what I loved was the forest. What I loved is wood and wood products. And I started to really understand wood in a more sophisticated way than I think we had historically talked about it. You know, the environmental movement is very understandably concerned about forestry. There's lots of good reason to be concerned about it. I am very much against the cutting of true old growth, although there's some challenges with defining what that is. But I'm very much about protecting the forest. But at the same time, when I look at the impact of climate, it is so much bigger than just any one forest. And the problem is humanity needs an enormous amount of building to be done over the next many decades. And concrete and steel are such a huge part of our global greenhouse gas emissions. They represent 11% together, if not more. And of all of our greenhouse gases, it's just from those two materials alone, steel and concrete. And we're trying to make them better, but it's very hard to make them seriously better, right? It's very, very hard. And so instead, wood is this material that captures carbon when a tree is growing. And when you cut it down and use it in a way that makes it last for generations, like in a building that can, you know, ideally we're designing buildings that last 100, 200, 300 years. When you do that, you're holding on to that carbon, you're sequestering it in the building. And as I started to understand and think about that, I realized that that means, you know, wood has this really important role in a shift of how we build cities. And it was interesting that the path for me was to go over, I was invited to Austria 20 years ago now, to help them look at, they were going to build for the Vancouver Olympics. They were going to build Vancouver House. And they asked me to come over and see, if it was a group of us, to see what they were up to over there. And I learned at that time about what now we call mass timber. At the time, there were different products. It didn't actually have that name, mass timber. And in fact, weirdly, I kind of authored the term mass timber that the world uses today, which is a really strange thing to come up with a term that's now ubiquitous in the world. But, you know, mass timber was this product being used in Europe just to make small houses. And I knew that we couldn't use it in North America that way because light wood frame construction, 2x4 type construction, is so inexpensive. And so the sort of light bulb moment was to say, this amazing product that's huge sheets of glued together wood to make huge components has this other role, which is to build in urban environments and to build really bigger buildings, taller buildings and bigger buildings and types of buildings that we historically didn't build in wood. And that unlocked the problem that really has transformed my career. I wrote a book about what we call tall wood buildings. It was the first idea on that in the world, and with a good friend of mine, Andrew Waugh, in the UK. And now it's, you know, arguably the single largest conversation in the world of architecture globally now. And as a business, that took me from, you know, small business in Gastown in Vancouver, you know, to where we are now, where we've been so fortunate and grateful to be sort of a player on the world stage as an architecture firm, which is quite unheard of as a Canadian firm. So we're grateful for that.
And so mass timber at the time when you saw it was being used in a residential setting, and you said there's an opportunity to use this on a larger building scale in North America. But was anybody even producing mass timber type of wood products when you brought this idea back to Canada? Was there any infrastructure to start doing this?
The answer is yes and no. So the product that some people, the audience might have heard of now, is called cross-laminated timber, or CLT, we call it. And it's at that time, it was only made in Europe. And the first building that I feel like really I started diving into this question of using these large panels of wood was actually City Hall in North Vancouver. And at the time, I couldn't get these big panels. And so I decided to design with a product that's called laminated strand lumber, which is a big panel that gets cut up into small pieces by the manufacturer. These are big manufacturers, Weyerhaeuser and now Louisiana Pacific. And they cut it up into small pieces and it goes into lightwood frame construction. And I called them up and said, hey, can I actually just get the big panel instead of getting it cut up? And they said no. And it's a kind of funny story about how world economics changes innovation opportunity, because that was around 2007. And in 2007, they said, no, we're not going to, we just make lots of money cutting these panels up. We're not going to give you a full-size panel. And then all of a sudden, 2008 hit and the global economy collapsed. And they called me back and said, you know, maybe we'd be willing to sell you a full-size panel. And that allowed us to basically create a material that wasn't being thought of and showcase it in a building that was really successful for City Hall. And then slowly these new products started coming online in North America. We built the first single family house before us, but we built Ronald McDonald House at the Children's Hospital in Vancouver using cross-laminated timber. And that would be the first building of its type in North America built with that material. And then we went right after that in 2012, we built the first tall wood building in North America, which was called the Wood Innovation Design Center, which was built for the province of BC and Prince George. And again, showed how these products could be used to really transform the entire way we thought about the future of the city. And really, it's been just an unbelievable, you know, incline of uptake around the world, in part because we were able to show how to do it, but more importantly, why to do it, which is really about massive reductions in the carbon footprint of a building by simply using the right materials. And that's what we're most proud of. Obviously, that's the motivation. And, you know, we can talk more about it, but, that's also just the beginning, because that's a good solution, but it's not the best solution. And when it comes to climate, we need to constantly be thinking, what's good, but how do we get better? And so I'm very, very focused on what's next. You know, thankfully, we're able to transform the global building process and help create this movement globally. But it's also like, don't rest on those laurels. Let's really start thinking about what's next, because that's a good solution, but not the best solution.
Yeah. And I guess from your perspective, your impact over these years is that you're at the forefront where now there's probably a lot of wave of people using this product, but to be at the forefront again of future opportunities and future solutions, it's such a unique position because, you know, if you think about a lot of businesses will try to put out a solution. And then once that market gets really built and people are doing more, we'll try to capitalize on as much as they can for as long as they can. But it sounds like what you're looking to do is obviously you've done that and you're doing it and you're still going to do it, but you're also trying to think about that next evolution of the next product to even further this chapter of really being impactful and bringing up another solution. So, you know, when you think of what's in the future for buildings and putting another solution into the future, what are you kind of working on or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so it's pretty exciting, actually. I think you're right. I mean, we could simply build all these mass timber buildings, and we certainly are building mass timber because today it's the right thing to do. But one of the fortunes of going through this process of helping transform an industry that was very resistant to change, and we're still trying to transform this industry that's resistant to change. Part of the fortune of that was we learned the process of changing the industry and realized that there is actually a template of how to make change happen. And that by following that template, we can continue to make other changes happen. Our motivation is interesting. I'm motivated not by the economics of the choices we make as a business, but by the influence of what we do. And I think it kind of relates back to, you know, Simon Sinek's excellent story of why. When you can speak to your purpose as a company, like-minded companies come to you and the business opportunities come. But you need to be true to your heart, you know, to that purpose. And my purpose has remained, we need to solve this climate crisis. We need to be extremely ambitious and aggressive, and we need to make change happen as fast as possible. And so to do that, wood is a great solution for now. It's the best solution for building, certainly in places in the world where there's sustainable forestry, you know, which is a word that's quite complicated and means different things in different places. But for now, it's the right thing to do in places where the wood can be sourced responsibly. But it's not the right thing to do in parts of the world where wood is being cut incorrectly and not being replanted or can't regrow or there are no forests that exist. And so we really need to solve, because I think as an architect, my job is to solve for humanity, to solve real human issues. And we need to solve for the lion's share of the global population that don't live in places where wood is a solution. And so we've focused on two sides of that conversation. One is, how do bio-based materials, plant-based materials, how can they completely revolutionize the built environment? I actually believe, as the listener looks around the room they're sitting in, I believe that everything in the room, literally everything in the room, can be made out of a plant-based technology with today's technology. That's not a fantasy. That's actually possible today with the technology we know. We just haven't really imagined what that's going to look like. And I literally mean you can make clear glass out of plant-based materials. So we think that that's a huge shift that needs to happen over the next 50 years, and that we need to be innovating today so that 30 years from now, those products are fully incorporated into the built environment. It takes time. So that's one focus. The other focus is really on the ability to use reclaimed materials and waste, just generally waste. So even some of the plant-based things we're focused on is how do we look at the single largest material, waste material produced on the planet is agricultural waste. Well, that's got all kinds of other values to us and actually can become the building materials of the future. And I don't mean mushed together agricultural waste making walls. I mean, really sophisticated technological materials that can create things that are as sophisticated looking as anything you've seen in the built world, but again, made out of a plant. And then other aspects of reclaimed materials, of taking old bricks and other things to recreate new buildings or to break down other kinds of landfill waste into creating new building products. And so again, plant-based and reclaimed is the future of the built environment in our mind. And that's what we're focused on next.
Yeah, and I read the book by John Vallant, and lucky to hear him speak a few weeks ago. And he talked about in his recent book, Fireweather, just like looking around you in a room, that a fire today is just fueled so much worse because of everything that we have mostly in our houses built a lot of from the petroleum-based products to furniture to all these different things that are around us. And that kind of switch to thinking more of what's naturally available. So have you had the opportunity to take that idea and put it into a design or into an opportunity into the future to start testing this idea?
So the answer to that is yes and no. I'd say that, you know, we are constantly sort of at the forefront of the wood products side of things, what's coming in the world. We, thankfully, because we've been able to retain this sort of role as a leader in that field, that any new product that comes online anywhere in the world, the manufacturer wants us to see it and use it. And so we get a window into the future on that wood side. On the plant-based side, it's a lot more complicated. I'd say there's two parts to the role that we see ourselves playing. One is I would like to be more engaged in the lab side of, you know, the real hands-on side of creating these products, like, because I find it interesting. But the reality for me is I run a 45-person architecture firm with my partner, Natalie, and I don't have the capacity to be working at that level. And so as I've sort of seen my role and my voice, I've realized that we have a better ability to actually raise the capital and raise the awareness to the global investment community. And that would be a more powerful use of my time than the actual process of being and getting my hands dirty, as much as I love getting my hands dirty. And so to that extent, we're kind of in the beginning stages of starting something we call the Center for Architectural Investment, which is going to be a New York-based organization that really speaks to the future of investment and in these new ideas. And to explain to the investor audience that, you know, the building industry and the volume of materials that go into it dwarfs any other industry on the planet. And yet it's this vacuum of any real investment and a vacuum of any real material innovation. And so, you know, diverting funds from, you know, investing in the next video game to investing in a material that could transform the lives of humans all over the world is what I'm mostly keen on. And, you know, the way I put that argument forward to investors, or the explanation I put forward, is quite simple. Hands down, the volume of material that goes into buildings is by far the largest volume of material humans produce on this planet. It represents not just 42% of global climate impact. It actually represents, on average, you know, 10 to 20% of most countries' GDP. It is staggeringly huge economic opportunity that anybody that gets it right makes Tesla look like a tiny, tiny, tiny entity. But isn't it strange that we're not thinking that way? And I hold my industry accountable for not thinking that way, but also not even talking that way. Until we talk that way, we can't convince the type of investment, and not just private, but public sector investment, into the kinds of transformation that the industry needs. And so that's where we're going to spend a lot of my next decade.
I wanted to take a second to tell you about our Season 2 sponsor, Springwise. Springwise is the global ESG innovation platform that offers its readers early access to the ideas transforming our world. I actually started using Springwise probably 10 years ago to review innovative startup ideas, and I've been a fan ever since. There are three new stories on the site every weekday featuring solutions to some of the biggest challenges we face as a global community. You'll find innovations in climate tech, renewable energy, plastic alternatives, the circular economy, and how we can live a more sustainable life. The stories are sourced and written by the Springwise team of journalists and will give you an inspiring take on what's right around the corner, whether you read it to inform your work or simply for a regular dose of optimism. Springwise sets the innovation agenda. The newsletter is free to access, and to sign up, visit springwise.com/newsletter-signup. Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please share it. And also, don't forget, subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review. I think what you're identifying is a really interesting point, is that there is so much material and so much money being spent there. You know, investors should be looking at this as a place to invest because the market is already spending on it. You just have to find that opportunity and the solution. And I bet you in the future, that solution is going to be just as cost effective, if not better, last longer, and solve a host of other problems. And that's what you're starting to see in a lot of different areas.
Yeah, that's right. And I agree, it'll be better. The way I've always looked at it is that when it comes to buildings, the lion's share of the material goes into the building's structure, you know, what holds it up. And really only four materials have built the structures of the world. That's steel, concrete, masonry, which is brick and concrete block, and wood. Those four materials have been the lion's share of city building all over the world. Steel and concrete came about, you know, we've had cement from, you know, back to the Romans and before the Romans. And we've had iron, obviously, since the early days of human evolution. But what we did in the, you know, a century and a half ago in the Industrial Revolution is we made those two materials, the cheap, easy materials to build with. And we've never questioned it. We've never questioned that, those two materials. And we've never really sought to say, you know, certainly when we pushed them in the early days, they seemed great. But now that we see the environmental impact, the carbon impact of those two materials, my question is, why would we not deeply invest in something completely different? And as I said, you know, I think as good as forestry is and as good as wood is for, you know, places like Canada, Northern Europe, parts of the Southern Hemisphere, it's not the right solution for a lot of the world. And so why are we not really sinking our teeth into what's next? And that next is already available. It just needs to be developed. And so structure is our primary focus for that reason, because it is the lion's share of what we make on Earth.
You've obviously designed a lot of city buildings to offices that are quite large. How does all this typically play and factor into the residential market? Like, is it typically the change and the kind of highlighting of different opportunities and products and development ways? Is that typically done on the larger scale that then works its way down into residential? Like, how does that work its way into the two pieces? And obviously, big, large buildings is residential as well when you think about condos and big, large cities, but down into the kind of the smaller homes and in that market, like, do you see a similar path for that too?
Yes. And I should just say for the audience, so as a practice, as an architecture firm, we do single family houses and we do big buildings in Sweden and France. We're one of Google's main architects and doing big buildings for Google on the main campus in California. We're doing a lot of work for First Nations communities here in British Columbia that are quite small, modest buildings. And we really look to understand a huge range of building types, because it actually is something we're curious about, right? We want to help our community. We want to help our clients make great buildings that build the quality of their community. And so we're also looking at how these materials and these choices we make that are pro-climate, how they affect big and small. And how we do that in a really cost-effective way is the critical part, right? So unless we try those different types of buildings, we're not going to be able to answer just that question you're asking me. The hard thing with single family, it's what we're all used to, but it's actually not what we should be building for the most part. What we know is suburban sprawl has been a huge component of climate impact, because it spreads the houses out, tends to build a car culture. Canada's done a lot of this in our cities from coast to coast. You can make an individual house better for climate, but if it sits in a suburb that requires you to drive every day, you're really not answering the right question. And we're not really actually strengthening our communities that much. You know, I think it's funny, everybody has that image, that 1950s or even 1990s image of the cul-de-sac and all the kids playing. That's a great space in suburbia, right? That's a great place. But a lot of the rest of suburbia has created this sort of disconnect where you're in your car instead of with your community. And so we're learning about the future of city building isn't just about the materials we build with, but also the size and character of the buildings we build. We invented this idea of tall wood buildings, again, with my friend Andrew Waugh in the UK. And ironically, I'm not a huge believer in super, super tall buildings, because I don't think they create these strong community connections. And in alignment with our goals for climate, making climate better, I think we also have to be careful to make sure that our lives are better. And that means really focused on how buildings impact community building. And so the materials can be applied at all scales, but there's more to it than that, right? There's more to these decisions in our mind than just applying the materials to make a building slightly better from a climate point of view. We have to do a lot more than that.
You've had, you know, a lot of success focusing on mass timber, on climate-friendly solutions. You know, you built quite a large firm. You said, I think, 40-something employees across the board. What would you say to kind of entrepreneurs or people that are thinking about getting into climate or focusing their energy and effort into this problem that we have?
So I just very much subscribe to the idea that successful companies today have to be driven by purpose. And the only way to differentiate yourself is to be true to your purpose and show integrity in the way you show up. And so that purpose can be many, many, many things. We choose use climate as our singular purpose. Climate and community, I would say those two are both critically important to us. But I do very much subscribe that the choice that we made to make climate a priority at the beginning of my firm differentiated us certainly at the time, but it drew the kinds of clients like Google. You know, to have Google pick up the phone, and we've now built two substantial buildings on the main campus that they're moving into, and thankfully have just won some of the top awards in the world. It attracts those kinds of clients that you want that are values aligned. That's what this is about from a business point of view. But better yet, you're making a difference. You have something to hold on to be proud of. I do my work not just for my team and for my community, but I do it for my children. And I want my kids to look back at their dad and my grandkids, my great-grandkids, if I have them, to look back at the choices I made as a business and be proud of me. I honestly do not know how you do that if you're in oil and gas today. Nobody's going to be proud of you. It's like if you're pushing cigarettes. Nobody will be proud of you for the choices you're making. We all end up in a place in life that we kind of wonder, how did I get here? And maybe that ended up in oil and gas. But you don't have to stay there. And I don't mean that you have to leave the company you're in. You can transform the company you're in. You can transform. Every one of our industries has to think differently and transform. I believe we should all build our businesses with a sense of legacy. What is the world going to think of this business and the choices I've made in generations to come? That's very much a driver for how I make business decisions.
Yeah, incredibly said. And I think it's hard to not pinpoint this conversation and the work that you've done and your business success to that kind of beautiful mix of impact and purpose. And all of a sudden, that's, you know, a really, really successful business as well. And to lead that and have all of that throughout and the opportunities that it's led to is just a really good example. And what ends up happening is good things follow. And so, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. This was a really incredible conversation. How can people learn a little bit more about yourself or MGA?
Well, gratefully, we're quite Googleable now. You know, if you just plug into your Google search, Michael Green Architecture, you'll find not only our website, you'll find several TED Talks I've given, a lot of other talks I've given on different subjects that are hopefully trying to move the dial. And, you know, we're based in Vancouver and in Victoria. We have offices in BC, and we also are opening offices in New York and Barcelona. So we're really trying to have a footprint that makes a difference in as many corners of the world as we can.
Thank you. Yeah, please check out a lot of media on MGA and Michael, which is a big part of the success of bringing this kind of awareness. So really easy to find Michael and the work that they're doing. Michael, thank you so much again for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Marco.
Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please share it. And also, don't forget, subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review. Michael, that was a ton of fun to chat on the podcast. And I had done a little bit of research, and you had mentioned one time you don't do so well with rules. So how has that helped you both in business and in impact?
Yeah. You know, you just mentioned Yvon Chouinard and Patagonia. Yvon Chouinard's been a hero of mine since I was a kid. He's the founder of, or father of, some of the ice climbing tools I use for my sport, but also he very much has influenced my entire career. He is a rebel. I don't doubt that that wasn't part of the reason I'm bad at rules. But I think that's the thing, is that it's not so much that I'm bad at rules, it's that rules are constructs of human imagination, and therefore they are a continuum. They are not a fixed point. And so a bad rule needs to be changed. And we need, as society, as we have such huge problems to solve, we need to get way better at understanding that every rule can change. Some of the rules of physics, maybe not so much, but a lot of the human-made rules can be changed. It's been profoundly helpful because I think in my profession, there's a tendency to be pretty inside the boundaries. And it's really hard to innovate when you stay too inside those boundaries. So I've always believed that the more you can retain a kind of childlike state of curiosity and a little bit of that rebellious state of being a kid that doesn't want to follow the rules, ultimately, the more innovative and imaginative you can be.
Thanks so much for tuning into the episode of Someone Like You. We hope you found our discussions today really insightful. Next week, we'll dive into another entrepreneur founder building a business in climate, so stay tuned. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. It really, really helps us out. Follow us on LinkedIn, where we also post really great videos from this episode. Thanks again for listening, and we will catch you on the next episode.